Case number 12-5380, Henry Long Distance Telephone Service Federal Excise Tax Refund Litigation, MDL 1798, Oscar Bulula et al. Appellants, Anthony Baloney, Rosalba Bulula et al. Appellants versus United States of America, acting by and through the Internal Revenue Service et al. Mr. Bowen for Appellant Neelan Cohen, Mr. Johns for Appellants Oscar Bulula et al., and Ms. Del Sol for Appellees USA.
May it please the court.
Let's just hold on for a second until people get out, okay? Okay, let's go.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Mike Bowen. With the court's approval, Mr. Johns and I will be dividing argument on behalf of the taxpayers this morning, with me addressing the Administrative Procedure Act issues and Mr. Johns speaking to the attorney's fees issues. What is ultimately, we have asked to reserve 1 minute each for rebuttal. What is ultimately at stake on this appeal is whether the Internal Revenue Service is above the law. This controversy began when the IRS ignored a clear and unambiguous limitation on the scope of the federal telephone excise tax. The IRS then proceeded to defy the decision of the 11th Circuit in the American Bankers case and decisions by numerous additional federal appellate courts, including this court, rejecting that lawless interpretation and continuing, without legal authority, to exact billions upon billions of dollars from individual phone users. The Internal Revenue Service did not take a single step of any kind to remedy these unlawful exactions, except under pressure of litigation, specifically of this litigation, and even then it flouted the procedural provisions of the Administrative Procedure Act on what this court determined in Cohen 1 to be the flimsiest of pretexts. The IRS then successfully urged the court below to decline to engage the merits of the taxpayer's complaint despite this court's mandate in Cohen 1. It is that error that we have come to court this morning to ask the court to correct. The substantive issue under the Administrative Procedure Act can be resolved by answering a single, straightforward, and in my judgment, uncomplicated question, and that is, does Section 7422 of the Internal Revenue Code require the IRS to provide by regulation for a reasonable and non-arbitrary mechanism for taxpayers who have had these monies unlawfully exacted from them to get that money back? If the answer is yes, as the taxpayers contend, then that is discrete agency action required by law. The fundamental premise of the district court's decision was mistaken, and that decision must be reversed. The words in the statute are clear.
Do you want to maybe respond to the government's argument that this was a remand and we don't have jurisdiction?
Certainly, Your Honor. The government's position, in my judgment, is flawed.
I thought you might think that, but why?
Because, Your Honor, the remand here is de facto final. Nothing is going to happen on remand. In 22 months, nothing has happened. Nothing is going to happen. There is no reason for the IRS to take any action. This is the Ringsby case, and it was in Sierra Club that the government cited in post-briefing letter. The government said, you know, in Sierra Club, his most recent incarnation, this court distinguished Ringsby because further administrative action was precluded. Well, what precluded further administrative action in Ringsby was precisely what precludes it here, and that is the agency isn't going to do anything. Nothing further is going to happen. Nothing could happen that would make this decision entered on an express district court order for it as a final judgment more final. There isn't going to be any occasion to come back to the district court and say, well, now the IRS has done something else, and we can review that with a sharper record, or maybe it's made the whole problem go away. Nothing more is going to happen. If an agency can avoid remedying an injustice or a wrongdoing that it has committed by the simple expedient of doing nothing.
Don't we usually deal with that through mandamus?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that usually dealt with through mandamus? Isn't that the proper mechanism?
That was not, mandamus was not, well, certainly not the exclusive mechanism, Your Honor.
I'm not even sure how this theory of yours would work. So how many days, you have 60 days to file, 30 days to file a notice of appeal, right?
Yes.
Okay, so do we say they haven't done anything in those 30 days, therefore we have jurisdiction, or how do we do this?
Well, Your Honor, if the IRS, the way that you do it would be for the IRS to take some action, or the agency to take some action, and then say this is moot, or the appeal ought to be abandoned because there's no jurisdiction. But the fact is, we were not proceeding in a veil of ignorance here. We were not in a hypothetical situation. It was patently clear from day one, from the day the mandate in Cohen 1 came down, that the IRS was not going to do anything further unless a court told it to. That was the that was the point of their motion. We want a naked remand without any kind of direction. Have I answered your question?
Yes, but I mean, you've restated your conclusion. I still.
Well, Your Honor, when it comes, there is a body of law addressing this issue. All of that body of law is subject to the 30-day limitation of when you file a notice of appeal. We are told by that body of law, by this court and others, that the finality limitation is a practical rather than a technical one. And so you have to look at the practicalities. And we have cited case after case in which a court said, look, in this particular case, remand without direction is de facto a final order. This agency is doing nothing, and that means if we don't do something about it, it can do anything. Now,
your contention is that the Internal Revenue Service was under a statutory duty to promulgate regulations covering refund claims by these particular plaintiffs regarding this particular tax?
Well, to promulgate a regulation governing refund claims for the federal telephone excise tax, yes. We contend
it's specific. If the Internal Revenue Service already has regulations that deal with refunds that are claimed for overpayment of taxes, that wouldn't be good enough if they have to promulgate a regulation dealing specifically with this tax?
They have to. Yes, Your Honor.
Where do you get that from?
Section 7422.
7422 is not a statute dealing with this particular tax. It's the general statute on how you go about getting a refund. And it says you file a refund with the Internal Revenue Service, and then you wait 6 months or whatever it is, and then you can bring a suit. So how does that get you to the position that you're arguing now?
It says, Your Honor, the statute says that you must file that refund request under regulations made by the Department of the Treasury. Here there are no regulations providing for refund requests by individual phone users having this tax.
Phone users, but are there regulations dealing generally with how you go about getting a refund?
Certainly there are, and there are the regulations dealing with...
If in the absence of a specific regulation dealing with this tax, I ask again, how do you get that, that's required out of 7422?
Well, because the regulations that were in place relating to this tax said you don't use these mechanisms if you're an individual.
They've been
vacated. I'm sorry?
Those regulations have been vacated prospectively.
No, the notice 2650 has been vacated prospectively. The regulation that this court in Cohen 1 described as a virtual house of mirrors, a nightmare of blind alleys and dead ends, are still in force, and they are the only mechanism that's there. They are a mechanism that individual taxpayers, individual phone users, cannot use. I'm sensing skepticism, but...
I'm a bit confused. It's the first I heard that. So. You say the general regulations of the Treasury Department or the Internal Revenue Service preclude anybody from filing an administrative refund request for these taxes?
That was the position the government took that led up to Cohen 1, Your Honor.
But that's because they had a specific regulation in place.
No, they didn't. I beg your pardon, Your Honor. They didn't. The only regulations in place relating to this tax were regulations that said, do not use this if you are an individual phone user. There was no regulation providing, generally, specifically, or in any other fashion, with any other adverb, for individual phone users to attempt to recover this tax. And when individual phone users tried, the government said, no, you can't do that because that's not provided for by regulation. I see that my time has expired.
Yeah, that's the attorney's fees now.
I'm sorry?
We'll hear from your colleague on fees.
Thank you.
Unless you have some more questions, do you? Janice?
No.
No, okay. Let's do fees.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Ben Johns, also on behalf of the appellants. I'm going to be addressing the issues related to attorney's fees under the Equal Access to Justice Act. The issue there is whether the government has met its burden of demonstrating that its relevant conduct over the course of this case was substantially justified. As I'm going to explain, it has not done so. What the district court here did below was essentially looked at the record, saw that there was a dissenting opinion issued by this court en banc, and said, ipso facto, the existence of that dissenting opinion in and of itself is sufficient to invoke or confer a substantial justification defense on the government. Now, that is wrong as a legal matter because it's inconsistent with the text of the EAJA, and it's inconsistent with cases that have applied the Equal Access to Justice Act in this exact same context.
So if we agree with you, are we saying that the three dissenters' position was substantially unjustified?
Your Honor, what we're saying is...
No. Answer my question. If we write an opinion saying the government's position is substantially unjustified, aren't we saying the three dissenters' positions were substantially unjustified?
I don't think you necessarily need to say that their opinions were substantially...
Well, how do we say that? How do we draw that line? How do we say the government's position is substantially unjustified, but by the way, there's this dissent, but that wasn't.
The way you draw the line, Your Honor, is we've cited three cases in our opening brief that are in this exact same context, and that you have...
I know about that.
Okay, all right. So the way you draw the line, then, is you need to, per the statute, consider the entire course of the relevant conduct. And when you do that here, it's impossible to find that the government's conduct was substantially justified. And further to your question, Judge Tatel, it's important to note that the dissenting opinions from this court don't analyze the relevant conduct in this case that's applicable to an EAJA analysis because those are not EAJA opinions.
Well, don't part of your fees extend to the on-bank proceeding?
Well, that's certainly part of it,
okay.
Yes.
And the dissenters in the on-bank proceeding argued that this notice was not final. And I guess for us to award fees for that period of time, don't we have to say that position was substantially unjustified?
Your Honor, not necessarily.
No?
We've cited cases from three different circuits.
Don't tell me about the other circuits. I want to know how we do it in this case.
Well, again, Your Honor, the dissenting opinions themselves did not talk about the relevant conduct.
No, but they did talk about the issue before the on-bank court for which you're seeking fees.
They did, Your Honor, but the analysis under the EAJA is a little bit different from the issues that were there, which dealt with the Anti-Injunction Act and 7422 and issues related to ripeness and things like that. The EAJA and one of the district court errors made below calls for consideration of the entire course of the relevant conduct. So let's talk about the entire course of the relevant conduct, which I think addresses your question, Your Honor. This all really started with the 11th Circuit's decision in the American Bankers case. The government lost on the applicability of the telephone excise tax. In response to that loss, it didn't file an en banc petition in the 11th Circuit. It didn't seek cert in the Supreme Court. It issued notice 2005-79, which said, we don't care what the 11th Circuit just said. We're going to continue to collect this tax.
Does the IRS have that authority?
Perhaps it can try to do that, but that's the whole theory. That's initially what led us to file these cases, Your Honor. A federal executive branch agency doesn't have the power. It can try to issue a notice like that, but as a matter of basic separation of powers and constitutional law, a federal executive agency can't ignore a judicial branch. What's so significant about that notice is, again, it says we're going to continue to collect this tax.
What was the scope of the order in the 11th Circuit case? Did the court issue an injunction against the IRS?
That case,
preventing it from collecting the tax?
The American Bankers case from the 11th Circuit, I believe, was a straight-up refund claim. It wasn't a class action.
Okay.
It wasn't seeking equity.
So,
and the individual who brought that case got the refund.
Yeah, correct.
So where's the violation?
Yeah. The violation is you have an 11th Circuit decision, law of the case. This is what the law is in the 11th Circuit, okay? And ultimately, four other circuits agreed with the 11th Circuit.
Yeah, but the IRS, federal agencies generally aren't obligated to fold their tents just because one circuit rules against them.
Federal agencies are required to follow the law. And the law with the 11th Circuit...
all the time in the federal government, where one circuit goes one way, and then the agency wants to see if we can, if they can win and create a circuit split so the Supreme Court will take the case. And they litigate and litigate. There's been a lot of commentary about that. There have been hearings about whether that's legal or not legal, and Congress has looked into it, but it happens all the time.
But what's so unique about this case, Judge Randolph, is that the 11th Circuit said, again, this tax is inapplicable, it's relevant here, and the government continued to collect it within the 11th Circuit. So it's essentially the government, the IRS, has taken the position that, yeah, we recognize the 11th Circuit said this
and
tax...
Anybody in the 11th Circuit could have applied for a refund.
Right.
Why don't you go on to your next point about substantial, not substantially justified, so you don't lose your time, lose more of time here.
Thank you, Your Honor. The analysis below was incorrect as a legal matter because the EHAA is very specific about what needs to be considered in the Equal Access to Justice Act analysis. And it says that you need to consider the pre-litigation conduct and the conduct which led to the filing of this lawsuit, which we contend includes the issuance of those 2006-50. The district court, again, didn't do that. The next reason why the district court made an error relevant to the EHAA is that we have these cases, again, where we've cited other circuits. You have a dissenting opinion from a judge that agrees with the government on a dispositive legal issue, and the courts in those cases have held that the government was not substantially justified. And that's because, consistent with the text, you need to look at the entire course of the relevant conduct. And that brings me to my third point, which is when you do look at the entire course of the relevant conduct, you can't conclude...
Assume when you finish your sentence that we don't include the service's refusal to follow the 11th Circuit. Assume we don't agree with you about that. Or is that critical to your case?
It's important, but it's not dispositive.
Okay, so because the government make your case without that point.
The government's misconduct didn't end with Notice 2006-50. It vacated Notice 2006-50 with Notice 2006-50, which, of course, as we know and the court has held, is a rule within the meaning of the APA. We also know, and it's conceded, that the government didn't...
But where's the lack of substantial justification for that? I mean, there's hundreds of times where we find agencies' actions were arbitrary and capricious, but weren't, quote, not substantially justified.
Your Honor, it was procedurally deficient. It
doesn't
was a rule.
That's my point is that there are many cases where agency action can be substantively or procedurally deficient, and still we don't award fees under the EJA.
Well, that may be, Your Honor, but we think our position is...
Do you disagree with it?
I don't disagree with that premise, but I think this case is it was so clear. And again, when you factor in all of the relevant conduct...
Minus the IRS's behavior after the 11th Circuit.
Which, again, we think is relevant, but I understand your point. But so you have this procedural violation, and then you have the substantive flaws, which perhaps are a result of the government's not following the notice and comment requirement. This court has described this whole regime as putting taxpayers in a virtual house of mirrors, a virtual obstacle course. The en banc decision said that the IRS's conduct was startling. And what's more, the other piece of information...
There were three dissenters who didn't.
You're right. Yes, Your Honor, but they didn't. That decision didn't carry the day. And again, that's not dispositive to an EHAA analysis. And the final, if I may make one other point, Judge Taylor.
Sure.
The other piece of information that I think is relevant here that should be considered by the court is what we know today, which is 22 months after this notice was vacated by the district court, you heard from Mr. Bowen, the government's done nothing to fix it. And that notwithstanding the fact that you have $13 billion that was illegally collected by the government, which is conceded, and the government has refunded less than half of that amount, $5.7 billion. So when you review this under the correct legal standard for an EHA analysis, I think the result is that clear that the government was not substantially justified, and the district court decision that in five paragraphs of analysis that the existence of a dissenting opinion gives the government an automatic substantial justification defense is incorrect as a matter of law and as a matter of fact based on this record. So the district court should be reversed.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thanks. We'll hear from the government.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Ellen Dulce-Hull, and I represent the United States. This court held that Notice 2006-50, which provided a special procedure for filing refund claims for the telephone excise tax, was a binding rule, and that because it hadn't been promulgated, and it followed that because it hadn't been promulgated with notice and comment, it violated the APA. The district court's remedy vacating that Notice 2006-50 and remanding without further instructions was the correct result in response to that. And I think the Norton case makes this a really simple case on the merits, Norton versus Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. And that case makes clear.
But I thought the government didn't want us to get to the merits.
Well, I think, Your Honor, there are a lot of jurisdictional questions here.
Are you dropping those?
Well, I
don't
know.
Do you want us to just decide the merits?
No, Your Honor. I just think that they are much more complex than the merits, which are very straightforward under Norton.
But we have to deal with jurisdictional issues.
Which is why we included it in our brief and why we do, you know, as much as we'd like to see it come to an end, I think that there are jurisdictional questions
okay.
here because
but
the
you want to spend your time here on the merits.
Well, I think the black letter law rule in the circuit is that generally an agency order a remand to an agency means that the agency is supposed to have the chance to do something, and then the party who's aggrieved by that can challenge it in the agency.
Can you tell us today, is the IRS position that it will not try to repromulgate a regulation dealing with these particular refund claims?
Your Honor, we believe that under Norton there's no obligation to promulgate a regulation.
My question is it the IRS position as of today that it will not promulgate a new regulation dealing with the processing of these refund claims?
It's our position that they are not planning to promulgate a regulation dealing specifically with this regulation for several reasons. First of all,
the reasons. I'm just thinking about this in terms of appellate jurisdiction. If the case is essentially ended from the IRS point of view, because there's nothing that it's going to do on remand, and I know your position is we don't have to do anything.
Well, Your Honor, that wasn't quite your question. The issue is not whether the IRS is going to do nothing on remand, and that's not the case. Right. I mean, what did happen on remand is that the IRS issued an announcement. It was an amendment to announcement 2012-16, I believe is the number, that actually stated, as discussed in our brief, that actually stated that the notice had been vacated. It issued press releases in that regard, publicizing that it had been vacated and stating that it would still take claims until July 27, 2012, which it thought was within the outside edge of its discretion.
If the IRS is not going to re-promulgate, put out for notice and comment, and the sort of regulation that was vacated, then how is it possible for the plaintiffs to bring up for appellate review their claim that the district judge in remanding should have remanded with instructions?
Well, I think it was clear that announcement was issued on June 1st of 2012. At that point, the proceedings regarding fees were still ongoing in the district court. They certainly could have gone to the agency and petitioned the agency to do something more, and when the agency said no, they could have asked the
district
court.
That's a new case, though. That's not a continuation. If they file a request for rulemaking, that's an entirely new case. It's not a continuation of the remand. And so I ask again, do you understand my question?
I understand your question.
How can they bring up for appellate review their claim that the district court should have remanded with instructions if on remand, the IRS is not going to engage in any further rulemaking specifically aimed at this particular tax?
Well, I think that they could have asked, they sort of said to the district court at that point while there was still something going on, that nothing's happening, the district court needs to do something more, and they didn't. And I think, you know, generally these cases where things are remanded to the agency contemplate it's going to go back to the agency and then we'll come back up through the courts. And I think, you know, I to the extent that's troubling, that sort of follows from all those cases that say a remand to the agency is not final. But I think assuming that we can get past all that, I think this is a really simple case because Norton makes clear that the court can't order the government to do something that grants broad programmatic relief, which is what the specialized broad claim for reaching out to taxpayers and making sure they get refunds that they're asking for is. And moreover, Morton makes clear that the court can't order the agency to put a regulation in place that's not required under the law. And there's absolutely nothing in the Internal Revenue Code that requires this. Section 7422 is a provision limiting refund claims to those where there's been refund suits to those where there's been a claim duly filed in accordance with the residual law, which includes the number of statutory provisions as well as any regulations that exist. But it doesn't direct the commissioner to promulgate specific regulations. But even if it did, there is a regulation in place, Treasury Regulation 301.6402-2 is one of the several regulations that govern here. And I think that regulation specifies generally for taxes other than income taxes, which would include this excise tax, you use Form 843.
So can the plaintiffs now use, is that how they would get their refunds now?
Well, if they had done it immediately after the remand order, I think at this point there's just no viable statute of limitations argument. I mean, at this point, to do something more in order that
step back. So the remand order gave people how much more time to?
Well, the remand order simply vacated the notice.
Correct.
And at that point, I think in the interim of this litigation, Clintwood Elkhorn Mining came down in the Supreme Court, and it made clear Clintwood Elkhorn Mining, which is cited in our briefs, and that case makes clear that to claim a refund with the IRS, you have to comply with the time limits in Section 6511 of the Internal Revenue Code to file a claim.
What are those?
It's 2 years from the time the return is filed, or 3 years from the time on the tax is paid, I believe. 2 years from the I'm sorry, I got that backwards. 3 years from the time the return is filed, or 2 years from the time the tax is paid. And then if you file the claim, then you have to wait 6 months for the IRS to act, and if they don't act, you could still bring your suit. So if anybody had any questions about this, our announcement, I think the IRS's announcement right after the remand order made clear that you can file Form 843, we'll process it. If for any reason you don't get what you want, then you can come to the court under Section 7422. So there was a remedy in place. There was something that taxpayers could do, but I think I think Clintwood Elkhorn really limits
but
what the IRS can do.
For all practical purposes, if we affirm, this is over, right? Millions of people who didn't apply, for whatever reason, they're out.
Even
the government keeps the money.
Even to the
right?
extent that there was some theory
yes,
out
there.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. There's a 6-year statute of limitations generally on claims against the government, and that's now passed. So if there were any other theory that anybody could recover against the government on, it's passed. And I think there's a practical
matter. Let's assume, for the purpose of argument, that the claim that the plaintiffs make that the district court should have issued instructions to the Internal Revenue Service basically requiring them to promulgate a regulation that you say they don't. There's no requirement. Let's assume that that's a final decision for purposes. What do you do with the attorney's fees? Doesn't that also become final? Because if there's going to be no more proceedings in the Internal Revenue Service specific to this particular tax, then why isn't the request for interim fees essentially a request for final?
I think it probably is, Your Honor, and I think the district court correctly ruled that fees aren't appropriate in this case. As we set forth in our brief, we think that this case, because it is a tax case, is governed by Section 7430, so the common benefit fund theory that they've raised wouldn't even apply. But to the extent that you're looking at whether the government was substantially justified under which applies under either 7430 or under the Equal Access to Justice Act, Subpart D, Section 2412D. I think in either of those cases, the government clearly was substantially justified here. Lewis v. Barnhart, which is cited in our brief, held that it is appropriate to look to whether other judges have differed on a particular position. And I think here, the government's position that Notice 2006-50 was something that it could put out as a matter of policy without notice and comment was a reasonable position given the case law and the statutory scheme that gives the service discretion about whether to process claims. And I think it was reasonable to construe that as a statement of policy about how claims would be processed. Obviously, this court disagreed, but the Supreme Court has said that whether an agency is wrong, is not the question, but whether there's a reasonable basis for that position. And the district court, in fact, agreed with us on that. And then to the extent we further argued that there were was a bar in light of the Anti-Injunction Act and the Declaratory Judgment Act, as Judge Tatel pointed out, several judges of the en banc court agreed with our view on that. And certainly there was Supreme Court precedent and Bob Jones that indicated that there could be a broader construction of the Anti-Injunction Act, and certainly a real question about whether the Declaratory Judgment Act and Anti-Injunction Act were coterminous. So I think our position
and
in litigating this case—
And the Solicitor General's office must have agreed that otherwise you wouldn't have been allowed to file a petition for rehearing.
That is correct, Your Honor. They had to—the Solicitor General's office had to approve this. So the question was looked at a lot of levels by a lot of lawyers. And I think it's important to recognize that what happened in the American Bankers line of cases really isn't relevant here. It was a typical refund suit where there was a substantive issue of law that was questioned, and the government's basically constrained, if it disagrees with an outcome in one circuit, to continue litigating until the issue is resolved in multiple circuits, in more than one circuit. And I think several circuits decided this case back to back. We had won the first case in the district court, even though it was reversed by the 11th Circuit. And I think to continue litigating and go through, we had to go through the process of there was one court where we had to dissent and petition for rehearing en banc, and then the Solicitor General's office had to decide whether we should acquiesce or take it to the Supreme Court, and we didn't develop a circuit split, but that's sort of a normal process that the government has to go through, and it had to administratively deal with the fact that these carriers who had customers in all different geographic areas were collecting this tax, and it was sort of an unusual situation in that respect. So I think our position that we took in that case was completely reasonable, but really it doesn't govern here, and it's not part of what you have to look at for what's substantially justified. You have to look at how we responded to the situation once we acquiesced from the point of issuing notice to about 60 in this litigation.
I want to go back to something that Mr. Bowen said, which was, I think he said, there never was a regulation, I guess, that permitted individuals to seek a refund of this tax.
I think that's absolutely incorrect. Treasury Regulation 301.6402-2C specifies that 843 is the form for an excise tax.
Okay. So let me ask you about that, because maybe I have the wrong form. But 843, the form I'm looking at says, do not use Form 843 if your claim or request involves, and then it lists several things, including overpayment of an excise tax.
Well, I think the issue there is the meaning of the term overpayment. And it specifically says overpayment of an excise tax. It's reported, I believe, on a specific form, 720, I think, which mm-hmm. is the form for carriers. So if a carrier determined that it had paid too much, okay. it would have already reported it on 720. And the way the law works is if the carrier's already the carrier can claim the refund and then distribute it to its customer, and then the customer can file their own individual return, and they shouldn't be filing a refund claim for something that the carrier's already gotten back for them. So I think it's confusing language, Your Honor, and I think it deals
well, and the confusing language is still there.
I will acknowledge that. I checked that on the web the other day, and you were correct that does need to be corrected, Your Honor. But I think what's important here is that's not the forms and instructions are something that have been held not to have force of law, whereas the regulation does, and the regulation has always provided that Form 843 could be used here. And so I think anybody who filed out a claim on Form 843 would have had a valid refund claim. And I think we discussed in the first appeal, there also could have been an informal refund claim that could have been enough to keep the statute open, but it could be later perfected. And so I think if these taxpayers wanted their money back, they certainly had plenty of, anything that they filed at this point that said they wanted their money back would have gotten it. So that's really not.
Yeah. Well, it sounds as if, the argument, I'm sure they would like their money back. They would like everybody to get their money back. But it seems as if the argument that was really going on here was that there wasn't notice and comment, and so they didn't get to have an opportunity to talk about how that should be done.
Well, I think, Your Honor, these regulations that are in place have been in place for decades, and these have been, and I think once the notice that was troubling was vacated, we were left with the status quo of statutory schemes that the Supreme Court has upheld time and time again. I mean, places like Dahm, Bergkamp, then most recently Clintwood Upward Mining, and these regulations have withstood the test of time, and I think putting that status quo back in place makes sense. And all those regulations to start with were subject to notice and comment. And I think, you know, maybe the IRS shouldn't, you know, didn't have to issue notice 2006-50 to start with. But once it was gone, once it had been vacated, we were back to square one, you know, to the status quo that has long been upheld as sufficient. And I think that this idea that they could now come in and ask for a special scheme that's not called for by the statute is something that's completely contrary to the Supreme Court's holding in Norton and simply something the court can't do. And just my few minutes remaining, I wanted to just touch briefly on the common benefit theory and just point out that that would be to grant fees based on that theory here would be contrary to the Supreme Court's opinion in Alyeska, which makes very clear that that's something that's available where there's a small class of easily identifiable plaintiffs, and that's not, you know, and wouldn't it make sense for that group of people who are all going to benefit from the decision to share the fees? And this court in Grace v. Berger and the Fourth Circuit in Brazoncala have said that that theory doesn't extend to the situation where the government's a litigant and it would extend to all taxpayers. On the substantially justified
issue. So the Grace argument and the Alyeska are two separate points, right? They're not.
Yeah. Well, I think yeah,
either
the two,
one
they're
is dispositive.
Yes, they're related, though, to some extent, because I think the theory is the same. Okay. And just on the substantially justified issue, I'd also point out that there's case law cited in our brief that, you know, the fact that an issue is novel and something that is unique, it makes it not appropriate for awarding fees. And the generally, the position we find substantially justified when it's a novel case. And as this court recognized, this is the proceedings in Cohen 1 and the Elmbach proceedings were a sui generis case, and I think that makes fees inappropriate here. Are there any further questions?
Anything, right?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Did Mr. Bowen or Mr. Johnson have any time left? Okay, you can each take 1 minute if you'd like it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will make 2 points. I don't think they'll take a minute between them.
Well, you have
no.
a minute.
Sorry?
I said you have a minute.
Right.
You can use it all.
Okay. Your Honor, if the court please, when the IRS, when it promulgated Notice 2006-50, took agency action, that agency action deformed the refund process, even if it had no obligation before then to take action, providing a refund path in defiance of the what it says on its own form. It had an obligation at that point, once that notice was promulgated. The IRS made the mess. The IRS has to clean it up. Finally, we cited nearly identical language in a closely analogous case saying that a closely analogous statute did impose a regulatory obligation. The government had no response. International Multifoods, government had no response. The state of Maddox, government had no response. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Johns?
There are 4 points I'd like to make, Your Honors. Number one, this isn't a matter of the IRS simply ignoring circuit courts. This is a matter of the IRS collecting a tax that it had no statutory basis and no statutory authority to collect, a la the American Bankers and other cases that have addressed that issue. Second, just to make sure our position is clear, we're not saying that the court should ignore the existence of dissenting opinions. We're saying that the existence of dissenting opinions is not by itself dispositive to the EAJA substantial justification analysis. And that's what the district court did.
What you do with it occurred to me that under Rule 35 of the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure, this court and all the other courts of appeals will order in bank for questions of grave importance or, you know, some very important questions. Well, so the panel opinion comes down and a majority of the active judges on our court vote to embank it. Isn't that an indication that there was a question of exceptional importance, that's the language, with regard to the correctness of the panel decision?
Well, no, Your Honor.
Because the rule, that's the rule. That's why we embank cases.
Understood, Your Honor. But again, the issues that were at issue in the en banc decision and the reasons why the court and the issues that this court granted en banc review for are different from the body of conduct and issues that are relevant in EAJA analysis.
But you're
and
seeking that, fees for that work.
Yes, we're seeking fees for our work on the case, correct.
Right. So,
correct. But
so what's your answer to Judge Randolph then?
My answer is
it can't be that it can't be what you just said, because a significant amount of your fees are for that case.
But our fees are the issues that are relevant to determining whether we're entitled to a fee under the EAJA.
What about the part of your fee request that is for the on-bay appeal?
I'm sorry?
What about the part of your fee, your request for fees for the on-bay review? Just focus on that.
Okay.
Okay, so given that request, what's your answer to Judge Randolph?
My answer is that the en banc court didn't grant en banc review related to our fee request. That wasn't even on the horizon. What the en banc court wanted to hear en banc review questions were issues related to the DJA and the AIA. And those are technical jurisdictional issues, and the analysis ultimately of both the majority opinion and the dissenting opinion didn't account for all of the facts, all of the factors and issues that need to go into a complete EAJA analysis.
Okay.
And so I think the existence of a dissenting opinion isn't dispositive in and of itself to substantial justification analysis.
Do you want to tell us your other 2 points?
Yes, thank you, Judge. Ms. Adele Sol made the point that the American Bankers line of cases is irrelevant. We disagree with that. This is relevant. All of these things are tied together. Notice 2006-50 didn't just get issued in a vacuum.
Point four?
The fourth point is that Ms. Del Sol also made the point about this case being novel and unusual, and that hurts the government more than it helps it. And it hurts the government because it shows that the seriousness of the APA violation, which Judge Urbino on remand described as unquestionably a serious deficiency. It's because this case was so extraordinary that the government should have followed the notice and comment procedures and solicited and considered input from affected stakeholders.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is submitted.